Good morning, everybody. Welcome along to the class. As you can see, our topic is how to develop bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is also called the mind seeking enlightenment for the benefit of others. Now, our class is sort of made up of sort of three sections. We've got the actual teaching itself, but during it, there's moments for a pause and reflection whereby you can ask questions. And there's also a section for a meditation. So we begin as we normally do by taking refuge together and generating the mind of enlightenment. We'll say the prayers together, and then I'll begin the actual class. So get comfortable in the seats. This basically entails that your back should be straight, shoulders relaxed, your hands and feet comfortable, and let your body breathe itself. And while your body continues to breathe itself, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he is sitting on a golden throne. He is surrounded by your spiritual teachers, other teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, meditational deities, and so forth. Meanwhile, on the ground surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, friends and family, strangers and difficult people, and all the animals. Imagine we're all facing the Buddha and his entourage. And our primary wish here is to overcome the suffering and its causes and develop all the good qualities of enlightenment so that we can help others effortlessly and spontaneously. So acknowledge that the Buddhas and the other enlightened beings who are in our presence have accomplished what we wish for. Now we are relying upon them and their methods to bring about the same type of result. So join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Imagine that as a result of this prayer of ours, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of the Buddha and all the enlightened beings surrounding him. And these lights and nectars wash over us and all the people surrounding us. And every obstacle to our wish for enlightenment is absolutely overcome. And the potential of all of our good qualities is freed. And within that state of freedom, we recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And we decide to establish these ourselves within our own mental continuum. So to affirm this, join me in reciting the prayer of these four boundless thoughts. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectars stream forth and they wash down over you and over all the people surrounding you. and every obstacle and hindrance to your practice vanishes, removed completely. And in their absence, all that's left are these good qualities. Then recollecting again the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above you. Acknowledge them as being the most beneficial field of merit. And by depending upon them, we're going to purify the mind a little more, and we're going to increase the merit that we've already gathered. To affirm this, join me in saying, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves clinging to the merit and the activities of purification to be objectively true, or to have true existence, imagine that you can transform your body, speech, and mind, all your merits, in fact, all your sense objects, transform them through your understanding of emptiness, and then have them dependently arise as a pure land that you can offer to the Buddha and his entourage. And join me in saying, now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyataya Homi. So you've released the offering, and the Buddha has accepted it, and he looks at you, and he smiles, and you meet his gaze. In the smiling presence of the Buddha, you feel accepted, you feel at ease, and with a sense of confidence that your practice will bear good fruit. So now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space, and it comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing the same direction you are. The emanation descends down to the level of your heart. It begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light, which pours out through the pores of your skin. It begins to fill the 10 directions of space. So that every being who exists within space is transformed by that light and finds himself established to now be within the enlightened state. So here, no difference between self and other. In fact, the terms do not even exist. When resting within that state, imagine that you can hear the resounding echoes of the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha, which establishes all beings on the path. So hearing it, you join in, try to feel the reverberations of the mantra within your body, and thinking that it's establishing the path upon your own mental continuum. Jayata Muni Muni Mahamaya Soho. Jayata Muni Muni Mahamaya Soho. Jayata Muni Muni Mahamaya. Oh. You recite this a few times under your breath. Oh, money, money. Oh, money. Tato mani mani maha munaya saha. From the 10 directions of space, the light begins to withdraw and it re-enters your heart. And you can feel the seat beneath you. You hear the sounds of traffic. You feel embodied once again, and you acknowledge that this meditation is one of imagination. But through the imaginative process, we've actually imprinted the mind with conditions to bring about enlightenment. So you think that further conditions need to be developed, the most important being the mind realizing emptiness and the mind that is determined to accomplish enlightenment for the benefit of all. So I think that over time you'll develop these two and become an actual Buddha. So just affirm that in your own mind. Think, this is why I'm studying. And then breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your open mouth. And just let your body move and bring yourself back into the room. Okay, so as you know, this is our third class. And I've been using quite a bit of material to present the meditation. And probably the best material I've come across is this book here in the middle on the top row. It's called In Praise of Great Compassion. It's the most comprehensive material I've found on the topic, and everything is sort of put in there. And what I found is the explanations are so very clear that they've clarified many of the questions and their answers when you're actually sitting in actual teachings. So, you know, when we sit in front of a Tibetan geshe, they will explain, and then it goes through an interpreter, and then it comes to us. And sometimes when that's done, like for me, I don't get it. And I've heard it twice the number of times, I still don't get it. But this book, open it up, now it's very clear. So it just depends on a very good translator like Venerable Thupten Chodron is, and have a very good understanding of the concepts and so forth. So I find this book the very best. Right next to it is called a book called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. That's got a very comprehensive presentation of bodhicitta. In fact, it's one large whole book, just like the book next to it. And a very, very inspiring book that I've used and taken quotes from is right down the bottom here called Way of the Bodhisattva. So that book explains the technique that we're talking about today in an engaging and thorough manner too. Anyway, and all the others are very useful, but if you were to buy one, I would suggest that In Praise of Great Compassion. Now, what we've covered already, well, we began by looking at impartiality, or what we call equanimity, and its types. So we looked at three types, and then last week I actually found another three. So there's actually quite a lot more different forms of equanimity. And in our next class, we looked at a type of equanimity. It's actually called mere equanimity. And it is the preliminary to the practice called the Sevenfold Cause and Effect Method for generating bodhicitta. Now, in this particular book I've been reading, His Holiness says it's called mere equanimity to let you know there is another type. And the other type is the Mahayana equanimity, because this equanimity is not necessarily Mahayana. The thing of friend, enemy, stranger, they do that in the Pali tradition too. So it's a common way, but it's not necessarily the Mahayana way of developing it. So today we're going to be looking at the Mahayana way of developing equanimity. And this equanimity is found within the equalized and exchanging self and others meditation. So briefly, there are two ways to develop this mind of enlightenment. One is this way, equanimity, equalizing and exchanging self with others. That's one way of developing mind of enlightenment. And the other way is the six causes and one effect. So here we're going to be today looking at sort of four questions to do with this type of equanimity. So this type of equanimity, as you'll see, is made up of 9 points. And they fit into sort of three categories. And you go through the categories and the 9 points, and you come up with three conclusions. So, like I said, this is the Mahayana way of developing equanimity, and it's called the uncommon way. So it depends upon two ways of looking at how things exist: through conventional truth and through ultimate truth. And we look at it through the conventional truth. We look at it from the point of view of others, self, and deep nature, or ultimate truth. Each of these categories has three major points. So in terms of others, we look at that others have an equal wish to be happy, they have an equal need to be happy, and they have an equal right to find relief from suffering. We'll go into each of these in a little bit more detail as we move to the next slide. I just want to introduce the concepts to you briefly like this. In terms of oneself, we look at the immense kindness of all sentient beings. The second point is how the kindness of others has actually outweighs the harm they've done to us. And in that category, we look at how actually when others harm us, it can be to our benefit. And finally, there's the certainty of impermanence and death. And finally, in terms of deepest nature or ultimate truth, sentient beings, these friends, enemies, strangers, and ourselves, in fact, anything that exists does not exist from its own side. And so that way, we are all the same. We are all equal. What this practically means is that when you search within your parts, within your body and mind, which are the parts that make up ourselves, in brief, you won't find yourself. Yourself is not there. But this is the same for everybody. They're the fact that these relationships that we have between one another, they are not stable. You know, they're changing all the time. So to hold some to be more important than others doesn't make a lot of sense here. And finally, this idea of dependent designation. Anything that does exist depends upon a basis for imputation and then the name. So for all of us here, right, we all have the basis for our designation is your body and mind. On that basis, each of you calls yourself I. We're all the same. So the idea is to become familiar with these reasons and what you conclude from them. And you go, okay, this is my way of going about in the world now. You try and see an equality between myself and others. Now, I'll just see how I did this. Okay, so then we'll go through each of these sections one at a time. So from the perspective of others, like we said, you know, everyone has an equal wish to be happy. So in other words, everyone equally wants happiness and freedom from suffering. Now, like I said, you know, you can have a fun exercise yourself and just go around and just ask, you know, people you know, do you want to be happy? And most people say, of course they do. If you ask them, do you like suffering? Do you want to suffer a little bit? They go, no. But, so we're all the same. Everybody's going to say something like that. Right? So that way we're all the same. So if we're all the same then, like that, discriminating amongst different people for how we act towards them doesn't make much sense, does it? Because, you know, people, even though people are just like us and they don't want to suffer, we say things that cause them suffering. We do things that cause them suffering. And then there are other people that, we expend more care towards, and others we just disregard altogether. So seeing that, you know, if you know everybody's the same, discriminating in that way and behaving in that way it's not rational, is it? But this is what we do, and sort of to come up with this idea and go, okay. I should also say that this type of equanimity and this type of meditation is really good, what they call for people of high intelligence, meaning, if you're a person who does a lot of thinking and a lot of activities are based on your thinking, this is a really good way to develop this type of equanimity. The other one is great if you're emotional, But you'll see later on they combine them both. So they put the emotional and then on top of the rationality to come together with, this is why I need to see everybody as being equal with myself. And so everybody has this equal wish for happiness, so discriminating among them is unsuitable. No point in being partial or discriminating, in other words. Everyone wants to be happy. Not only that, everybody has an equal need for happiness. So this next part they do is they give this example. So these are not really reasons here, this need and the last one, the actual, you know, the deserving to be free from suffering. These are sort of just illustrations. So this illustration here they often give is when you have 10 beggars or whole, you know, a crowd of beggars. So some of you might have been to India, and when that happens to you, right, it's very, very difficult if you find yourself in that position, where there's lots of people come. And if you give any one of them something, more come. And so what Allah would normally do is just give some to some and get the heck out of there, right? And I think that's what, because you can't give it all to the Kenya, but they're all equally deserving, aren't they? I mean, they all need that money for food or whatever they, or for their families or whatever they need it for. Each one of them there with their hands outstretched for it. So he sort of said, look, this, it's really senseless to have any preference for them. So I'll just, you know, maybe you go, oh wow, she's got beautiful eyes, so here, you can have the money, but you don't have an arm, nah. Or you look more ugly than this one over here, or you smell, and you know, you're a bit better or something. So they use this idea of having 10 beggars, 10 people approaching you for assistance, and you going, well, which one should I give it to? You discriminate like that, when actually there's no need for that preference, is there? They all have the same wish. They all need to support themselves and their families or whatever. So we try to benefit everyone equally. And then they use this other image of a lot of people being unwell or sick in a hospital. And it's the same idea. You imagine, okay, here comes the doctor or the nurse. So who does she help? What do you think? When you're in hospital, who do the nurses and the doctors help? Everybody. That's right. They just don't come to you and help you and go, hey, forget about everybody else. Right? Or they don't go to somebody out there and just leave you alone, do they? Like, you're important to them too. And this is the idea too, for us to go, okay, you know what? Everybody's suffering. Who was I talking? Oh, it was upstairs. So Ian was just telling me how important it is to look after your health as you get older. He said he goes to the doctors to have more checkups and things like that. And I really don't. You know, I wait till I get sick or something goes wrong and then it's time to go. But he's going, no, that's not, you can't, that's not the way to approach it. So everyone actually has an equal right to be relieved from their suffering. So there's no real moral justification for us to be biased, not to just help some who are suffering and others who are not. So the conclusion is, so that's why I put this sort of picture up. You know? So as you can see, we'll go through like this. You get, each time there's a little explanation here of the perspective, then the reasons, and then the conclusion. So the conclusion drawn here is like this. As you can see, as there's no rational basis at all for me to be biased towards any sentient being, there are no grounds for neglecting the welfare of a single sentient being. And so I should care as deeply for you as I care for myself. So when we have this, we have to train the mind in this attitude expressed as follows. His Holiness says, I shall never discriminate between beings. We will always work equally to help them overcome suffering and gain happiness. Does this make sense to you? Do you have any questions at all? In fact, there's a lovely thing that His Holiness said about this practice, that in fact that if we don't do this practice, what happens is there's only a few people in the world that'll be like happy and have what they want, and a heap of them that won't. Right? And we see this playing out in the world now. Right? And what do you think those people are going to do? Huge mass of people that are not happy and are suffering and feel as if the others don't care about them. That's right. Just like in the past, isn't it? People rise up, whole countries rise up, revolution. And it's happening all around us. But again, we see the same thing happen. Whoever takes the power, they always go, I'm different than you. You're different than me. I am this, you are that. And it plays out again. Debbie? So Carl, what did you say? You said... So Carl was saying if we applied this principle, we'd treat people in prisons very, very differently. In fact, I remember one time reading somewhere that said the way to discriminate, you know, to discern which is a civilized country and those that are not, you just look at how each country treats the poorest, or the sickest, or the people who have the least of all. And so we see it, and even in our democracies, aren't there? There's still a huge thing to go more towards those who have more, and those who have less, take more away from them. And even when I was going through this, I thought, oh my gosh, imagine if people were trained in this idea. It's like I said, you can't refute this. That's the lovely thing about it. You know, His Holiness actually says, he says, when we question our innate assumption of self-importance, we find that it is false, that we and others are equal in wanting happiness and wishing to be free from suffering. We and others have the same right to be happy and free of suffering because all of us equally have what we call Buddha nature. Try as we may, we cannot form a valid reason why our happiness is more important than others and why our suffering hurts more than theirs. So some of they say things like this, what I try and do is, you know, refute them, go, hang on, I can find one. And you have a go, and then you can't. You know, like I was saying before, we all have a sense of self. Right? Everybody does. So we're equal there. We're all equal in that when you look for this real self, you don't find it. No one will find it. So we're all equal there. Right? So it's just a belief and this feeling that I matter more than you. It's a very sharp meditation you can do to challenge this idea. So, you know, so we live in a democracy and we all have a vote. So we're equal in having a vote, aren't we? So you imagine like if you have yourself where you are and there's everybody else where they are. And we're going to vote on something. Whose vote is most important? Right? Well, Cal says his own, but the democracy says the majority is more important, isn't it? It's really not sensible, is it? It's not rational because we've got 1, 4, 7. We've got about 10 people here, right? So we're saying, hey, just take this group of 10, put yourself off to the side here, and now ask yourself, who's more important here, me or the other 9 people? But the 7-2 is a number, especially in democracies. Well, it's the majority, isn't it? It's the majority's happiness. But from our own perspective, it's my happiness. So that's one exercise that His Holiness is actually set up. Ask for a boat. You know, so you go there, who's more important? You go like that, you go, well, what do you think, guys? You all go, put your hand up. No, I'm more important. You know, and suddenly you've got nine people whose importance is more against the one.
You've got seven postal votes too.
Okay. Thank you, David. What was the other one he did? It's a similar type thing. You put yourself to the side, you put the other people to one side. Ah, yes, that's right. So, okay, so you just like here, and you go and ask yourself, so whose suffering is more important? My own, or the suffering of these other nine people? So actually, it's all important, isn't it? Suffering is equally important to each one of us individually. That's true. But then if you ask yourself, well, where is the greater need for overcoming the suffering? Surely it's got to be for the whole rather than a part. You know, these are ways you can challenge the self-cherishing. In fact, this meditation is very different than the other one. This is quite direct, and it was kept secret for a long, long time in Tibet, because it did require a sense of courage on your part, because this directly attacks the self-grasping and the self-cherishing. Through the reason, and lots of people don't want to do that. There's in a sense like too much for them. It's going to go straight. It's going to straight go there. It's going to ask me, it's like, who is the person that has self-esteem? This is because you've got an ultimate perspective in here. The other one doesn't do that. So Mel said yes, because this is going to come straight at you and attack can affect self-esteem. So here we have to have a little thing here to determine, like, self-esteem is required in this path. Right? You have to have a good, strong sense of self to do this, right? To want to become enlightened. But at the same time, that sense of self does not inherently exist. It conventionally exists. So yes, we, like I said, we all have a sense of self. That does exist. And that sense, we're saying, yeah, and that sense of self, this one, it legitimately exists. I wish to become enlightened. Well, you can have a sense of self that you're a bad person, but you can also have a sense of self that you're a good person. And these are senses that conventionally exist. The problem with the things that conventionally exist, there's one part of our mind called self-grasping, ignorance, and it latches on to the conventional self and also misapprehends it, also that the self appears back to us in a false way. But we don't know that, we believe it. And so there's this ignorant part, and there's also a good part that goes with it, or an ignorant part and a bad part that goes with it. It makes no difference here. And that's where all the karma is created. That's how the karma starts off, right? And then all the afflictions and so forth. Yes, you do. Yes, we all do. Yeah, that's right. So Pierre was saying that he listened to a teaching of His Holiness in Montreal, was it? In Montreal. And there His Holiness was talking about that if we wanted world peace, we have to disarm ourselves. And I even thought that another similar thing like this was really strange. We want world peace, which is like the whole, isn't it? The whole world to be at peace. But the whole world is made up of individuals. You can't have a whole world of peace if the individuals are upset and angry and upset. Can't be. So if you want the whole, you have to start with the individual. And that's us. And if all the individuals are at peace, we have a peaceful world. But you can never have a peaceful world if the individuals are not at peace. If the parts are not at peace, the whole can't be. Right. This is a great thing to remember. There's a lot of injustices and wrongs in the world, right? It can be sort of upsetting, and we should do our best to do something about it, to right those wrongs. But approaching those wrongs with anger ourselves will not solve it. Because we still have anger, don't we? Yeah, we fix something wrong that's in the world. Guess what? There's still an angry person in the world. And that's the real source. Like, anger's not out there. You know, within sentient beings like us within our own mind. So let's have a look at the next little one. So here from the perspective of self, here we consider the immense kindness of others and how kindness outweighs harm, and finally the certainty of impermanence and death. So just to say about a little bit about each of these. So this here is done on the idea that it's going to be past and future lives. And so you can look at, so look at where you are. The way I do this, I just look at where I am now, right? And goes, okay, so could you be the person you are now without the assistance of others? And the answer to you is actually very clear. The answer is no. Like, for instance, all of us needed a mother to be born, to even come into this world. So there you go, a mother assists us to come into the world, and the mother assists us by carrying us through the world. Heap. Right? Then, like, while we're in the world, we have to eat. Where's the food come from? From others. Right? Then the clothing, where does that come from? Well, from others. Now, your mother either makes it or she buys it, which means somebody else made it. Where do your shoes come from? Your education, the house you're living in. You start thinking, it's like, oh my gosh, it's like we did very little, isn't it? We just came in and here it all was, and people just supported us. And so this idea here is to, like, you know, remember this great kindness of every other living being. So you know what? You know, if you look across here, you might think, oh, there's a person walking across the road. So how are they kind to me? Like, I don't even know them, what we think. You know? But I did this once walking up to the old center many years ago, and there's a couple, you know, wheeling along their pram, and I'm on one side of the road looking, and I'm going, oh, thank God I'm not in Beirut, because these people over here who I don't know could shoot at me or throw stones at me, and they're not. Isn't that kind? You know, it's the same, you know, if a person, when they walk past the street and they smile or don't even acknowledge you, that's a heck of a lot kinder than hitting you or saying something unkind to you, isn't it? He said, the kindness of just restraining themselves from saying anything harsh to me. Thank you. In fact, Miffy told me a story a few years ago where there's an elderly gentleman up towards the Gold Coast, I think it was, watering his lawn, and there were water restrictions on. And a young fellow walked past and said something unkind, you know, about using the water. And the old man, for whatever reason, just turned his hose around and squirted the bloke. So this bloke hopped over his fence. Then the man with the hose had a heart attack. And then he dies. Like, wow, talk about cause and effect. Right? And just from this idea of thinking, as far as harming me, was harming it. The other guy's going, oh, harming the environment by watering it. We need to keep our water. I'm going to say something. Right? The old man feeling he's been harmed by the young man's slight. So he does something. Young man, now I'm harmed by the spray of water. I'm going to do something. Just like, oh my gosh. There's lots and lots of events that play out like this. And it's just from forgetting the kindness of the other person. Another thing is, the holiness says, well, you might argue that, yes, okay, but everybody's been kind to us, but so have they all been harmful to us. They've all hurt us too. And that's true. Now, if you look at this equanimity, that's how you've got to look at it. Throughout countless ages, beings have helped us, harmed us, and been indifferent to us. And so in that way, you know, everyone's sort of equal. Because, you know, as you know, the people who might have harmed us will later become indifferent to us. Then later on, they'll be kind to us. Those who are kind become indifferent, then they harm. And so it's a big mashup. You know? And that's right across the board. There isn't anybody who's always like being a friend to us unless they're the Buddhas. But in terms of sentient beings, no one. They change. So right throughout this, and somebody says, oh, well, you might think now, if that's the case that everybody's helped us, haven't they also harmed us? Yeah. Yep, but is it even? And he'd say, no. In fact, the kindness of others is overwhelmed. It is much greater than the harm that others have done to us. Now you think about this, right? Like this week, how many people have hurt you? Said unkind things to you. They think, okay, if you get a number, so now how many haven't? Right? And you go, oh my gosh, the rest of the world, basically. Yeah, so the kindness of others in that way overwhelms easily the harm that's been done to us. Now, the other thing is that when others harm us, there's basically, you can say like three responses to harm. One is you could just be indifferent to it. Not easy. Most people aren't that way. But there are a number, there's times in your life you can be indifferent to the harms of others, can't you? But most times when people harm us, we don't like it. We need to, and we want to respond in the same way to sort of stop it. And as we know, it's like the whole, what did you say? What's that story about the blind, the whole world being blind? Blinded in one eye, I think. And where you hurt yourself, so you hurt somebody else. Suddenly everybody's hurt. Well, that's what we do, isn't it? Not such a good result. Wars are sort of, is that one side says, oh, you've hurt me or my country or whatever it is. I'm not taking that. Respond in a similar way. And the other side goes, well, I'm not copping that. Here we go. It's playing out all over the world, this idea. So what you can see here is what they call a lack of fortitude, a lack of patience. In other words, one side is being hurt and they can't just bear it. They've got to lash out back. But for spirits, and so that lashing back is what they call revenge, anger, all that sort of stuff. But if you don't lash back, it's called patience or fortitude, being able to bear the hurt. Now, as we know, at the presentation of the Dharma, we have samsaric beings and enlightened beings. So if you know you're not an enlightened being, you've got to conclude yourself in the samsaric being category. There's a lot of us. So all of us are hurting. We're afflicted by pain and suffering, physical and mental. So we try to deal with it, don't we? We try and find methods to deal with it. From a Buddhist perspective, these harms that are being done by others, when we understand, like, why are we being harmed by the other? That's what you've got to ask yourself. Yeah. So one answer to this is you have the karma. You yourself have harmed others in the past. The harm comes back to you. The other one is, like if you consider yourself a samsaric being, if you're not an enlightened being, you have the potential to experience pain and suffering, the three types of suffering the Buddhists talk about. The most important one here is the suffering of the all-pervasive conditioning. That's the one they're really talking about here, not so much ordinary pain and things like that. But like I said, the ordinary pain, the gross suffering, that really gets us to lash out, to be aggressive sometimes towards those we consider harming us. Now, I'll come right back to you, Pierre. Now, if we don't do this, and are patient. Like I said, so we've got all sentient beings who have been hurt in the past and they have hurt others and they continue to do so. You have done the same. So the Dhamma Zopa says it's like walking around with a big target on your back and saying, shoot me. You've got each of us carries the target. What's the target? Our past behaviors. If we have harmed others, we can be harmed ourselves. The cause is a harmful cause. The effect must be a harmful effect. And again, you know, the first noble truth of suffering says, look, you've got to understand people aren't in control of their bodies and minds. It is doing the best they can, but they don't understand the reality. So whatever they're doing, it's not going to be very skillful. So in fact, it's a natural thing to be hurt while we're in samsara, which is just cause and effect. It's also natural for us to harm. It's cause and effect. But once you understand the process here, the cause and effect process, you can interrupt it. Like we can say, you know, I'm not going to get so upset next time I'm with my parents. You know, this is the beginning, this is the Buddhist path. I'm going to restrain myself from physically harming someone, from verbally harming somebody. I'm going to restrain myself from taking things without asking. That's the beginning, because we understand, hey, it's what I do that causes my own suffering. Whether it's mental, physical, or verbal. What does it? It's, oh, stealing will cause it. I'm not going to steal them. You know? If you find yourself getting in lots of arguments, you have to acknowledge that partly this is because of what you're saying. If you don't talk, you can't argue. Right? So when you say stuff, like you've got to look at, am I saying stuff here to harm the other? Because if you are, you're going to harm yourself. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. And this is why karma is so important, to understand karma. Because it tells you that when you've got hurt, there's good reasons for that. And if you hurt back in response, it's just going to happen again. So Pierre was saying that, he confronts a situation and he's being hurt, then this understanding of karma, is that, you know, we could look at it through the lens of karma. That's right. Pierre's saying, so when he doesn't create it in the present, and this is right? So how you create in the present would be to respond in the same, you know, in a hurtful way. In fact, Rabina has said something really interesting to think about. She said, like, all feeling is karma. All feelings are karma. And if you think about it, of course it is. Right? So in other words, your feelings, the feeling that you have at present is determined by something that took place in the past. Now, it could be this life and past lives. Yeah, but it's always from the past, right? You can only have feelings, but because you need all the conditions in place, now you experience a feeling. Your mind or your senses have to make contact with something that you either find pleasurable or disturbing. And the feeling will arise. That's karma. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Really easy. That's right. In fact, in a way, it's really, yeah, I was thinking in many ways. No, that's right, Pierre. So when we understand karma, Pierre says, so it'd be much easier to forgive. He says, you betcha. Oh, of course it is. Yeah, because, you know, we're playing. One of the other things in Shanti Davis' text, The Way of the Bodhisattva, it says when you look at the causes of suffering, I know we look outwardly, but really when we do that, we're looking at conditions that produce suffering. So one of the, in terms of the cause, I said, well, just look at your body. Like if it didn't hurt when you were struck, right, you'd be fine. But it does hurt when we're struck. So your body is one of the causes or conditions for suffering. Now, anyway, if you say, I don't want to suffer, then don't have a body. Or what they say, then don't be born. Right? Because once we're born into this world, there's pain involved, straight up. Just because of the fact that you've got this human body. But like we know this, we see little babies, don't we? They come in and they're screaming, not all the time, but then later on it's like, well, don't feed them, see what happens. They'll start screaming then, don't they? Right? So why is that? Because they've got, it's just this body. It requires a whole lot of things. Like clothing, for instance, warmth, doesn't it? So he says, so one of the causes is your own body. So you can't just go, it's your fault. You hit me, you did this. Then we also have a mind that's not completely under our control. Well, that's our mind, right? So this is why you often see cases where somebody will say something quite nasty to a person and the person is calm about it. So same thing happens, another person is really upset about it. You know, well, why is that? So one person can control their mind to a certain degree and the other doesn't. So they're suffering. Demi. So like I said, this is just the idea of the kindness outweighing the harms that others do to us. So just look at today and just ask yourself how many times I've been harmed today and how many times have people not harmed me. The not harming overwhelms the harm. Then the other is, when they do harm me, is that useful to me? You go, yes, it is. Especially if you don't react in the way you normally do. You work off that karma. You've got the karma that causes to be hurt. You will be hurt. Don't create another cause to be hurt. That's what it's saying, right? Restrain yourself. Put an end to that one. And then there is a certainty of impermanence and death. So here, again, they give us a sort of an illustration of it. And their idea is to put a number of people together in a cell, in a prison cell. So you imagine, okay, I'm in a prison cell with these other people and we're all facing death. It's imminent. Now, does it make sense for you to argue and bicker with the people around you? I'd say no. Yeah, what's the point? Exactly right. What's the point? We're just going to distress ourselves before we're all executed. Rather silly, isn't it? And so again, it's like this thing of like looking at it like from our perspective. Well, we all are subject to death, and every one of us is subject to impermanence. We cannot stop change, right? So we can only stay here a little while. In fact, yesterday I got a thing on my feed that they said, no matter how well the technology works, the maximum lifespan for a human being, 156 years. Maximum. So there's some organs and how they're made up of the organ. You can change a lot of the human stuff, fine, but not these organs. So they gave you 156 years. So you can imagine, right, no matter how long you live, your cell is contained to 156 years, right? That's all you're going to get. Or less, of course. Right? So in that time, do you want to distress yourself? Do you want to have animosity amongst, you know, fellow beings? Doesn't make sense, does it? And I often think, you put a prison cell, it's just small, but then you go like that, well, that's the world. But the world is very small compared to the universe. Right? And this is the only place we know for certain where there's living beings like us. Right? And you look at what we're doing. Man, like tearing the planet down, distress, wars all over the place, right? There's this thing, not considering, like we're all subject to this. So the conclusion drawn from this one is that because I cannot distinguish between our desires, meaning my desires and your desires, I choose never to be intolerant of your happiness, and I choose to always help you overcome your suffering, as I do my own. Okay, so before we go into the next section, sort of the deepest nature or the ultimate, do you have any questions you'd like to ask, or is it sort of flowing along enough and making sort of sense to you? Yeah, I mean, it is. I know, I had the same. Oh, yep. Yeah, I mean, it's all workable. That's the thing. It's just finding the ways for us to work with it and become comfortable doing it. And if you want to be comfortable doing it, you have to start doing it. We just have to start doing it and find some things you can actually do it with. So I've just taken up to recently watching a show on television called Alone. That's a really interesting show to watch from a Buddhist perspective, because you can see that, what I see at least, is it's not the environment that creates the problems. The environment's harsh, really harsh, hard. What creates all the problems is how the people think. So I've seen them there where they, I was watching and I said, oh man, if you only knew a little bit about Buddhist training, you'd sail through this. So they would be there. You know, so one of the one I'm watching, I think they're up in Canada, Alaska, somewhere around there on the Vancouver Island. And one group of people, like they lasted one day. I couldn't believe it. I was, gosh. But anyway, what do they do? They get there and they start thinking about my wife, my children. They go, mate, your wife, your children, they're not here. Only way they're here is you put them here in your mind, and your way of thinking about them is that, oh, I miss them. And I go, so many of the thoughts that cause suffering are all based on I. That's what you hear. So, mate, you should be thinking, if you're going to use the word I, say, I'm doing this for you. You have to make them your major goal, not yourself. Because what happens when you think like that, you become more alone. Miss them more and more. And they give up. You have to go home. And I noticed another one the other day. So three guys were left. Came up to 50 days they'd done alone. And I was looking at going, oh God, I wonder if they start thinking, oh, if I can just do 50, I've made it. I'll do 50. So they did. And then the 51st one, too hard. It's done. I can't do any more. Nothing. That's right. Because you brought 50 into it. You thought this thing. And so it's tremendous. You see people drive themselves nuts, basically, and how you do it. That's what I find really interesting from a Buddhist perspective. And how they do it, it's nearly always I-focused, me-focused. And I thought, gosh, if you guys just need that simple Buddhist thing of like, try to discern when you're in here or when you're out there, right? Because if you just focus on your senses and look at your landscape, what do I need to do? I need to do these things. Some of them were saying, I just need to survive. I thought, wrong thought. You need to thrive. Don't think about coming home. This is your home. You notice, you can see one group, you know, an individual that thinks better than the others. And you see how they get up in the morning. First few words they say. So it's interesting to listen to what they say. As I listen, I go, the more negative words you use, the worse it is for you. You're describing your inner reality. And by describing it, becomes more real to you, more true. Well, your inner reality, what's that? It's just thoughts. I think it's more than thought. And that's what we do too. But it's nice to watch it there because it's quite extreme. You know, it comes up really quickly. And if you have a bit of background stuff about Buddhism, you can see it and go work out when you do it and now what not to do, because it produces suffering for yourself. Okay, so let's look at this next one. This is from the perspective of nature, or the deepest way of looking at things. And as Holiness says here, this ultimate should not be taken to refer to the ultimate truth in terms of emptiness. Rather, this is like the Heart Sutra. Now we have emptiness and then we have forms. And then they say, form is empty, emptiness is form. But what they're really meaning here is not just ordinary form, they're talking about the subtle, dependent arising. That's the conventional truth. So we're looking at sort of deeper levels of conventionality. So we have emptiness as form or form as emptiness. So here we're looking not at the emptiness side, but at the form side, but it's the subtle form. And the subtle form is phenomena, like forms, depend upon their name. Right? Just like we do. Right? We have, you know, this phenomena called the body. You know, what does that this word body depend upon? Or something else, doesn't it? Just put it on it. What does the word, you know, self depend upon? You've got to have something that you're calling self, or something that I'm calling I. Like, what is that? So this is about like investigating that in terms of the deeper nature. So, like he says, the holiness says this ultimate should not be taken to refer to the ultimate truth in terms of emptiness. Rather, it means that the outlook adopted in these visualizations is deeper and hence relatively ultimate in comparison to the earlier meditations. And I hope you'll see this as I try to explain it to you. So in other words, so we look at, first of all, the term called not from their own side. So friends, enemies, strangers, self, and I do not exist from their own side. They cannot be found within their basis of designation. How do they exist? In terms of mere name. So strangers exist in mere name. Because if you look, I'd never met Yvette before, and she was a stranger to me. I go, oh, she's a stranger to me. So, okay, well, where is the stranger if I look within this phenomena called Yvette? You won't find it. If I even look for Yvette herself, I won't find her. If I look for me, I won't find myself. You won't find the stranger that in all these phenomena, you won't find hatred. You won't find any phenomena that you can name that conventionally exists to exist from its own side. Because to conventionally exist and to exist from its own side are complete opposites. There isn't anything that conventionally exists and at the very same time exists from its own side. So this is what, so you become familiar with this. As Holiness, so it says in commentary, if friends, enemies, and strangers existed from their own side, which means inherently exist, rather than being mere imputations, then the Buddha would have seen this. And the Buddha never saw that, neither has anybody else ever since, because it's not there. And he says, but the Buddha makes no distinction between a person massaging him on one side and someone cutting him on the other. They're equally objects of his love and compassion. So this is a very advanced stage of practice, of course, where he was able to do that. But this is because he never saw a bad person cutting him. He knew there was no real me in here being cut. In fact, the activity itself wasn't real either. And of course, this only comes out through really deep investigation and meditation. From our perspective, it seemed near impossible, isn't it, that somebody could behave like that? But apparently, this is the case. And then the other is relationships are fluid and impermanent. Here it says, if friends, enemies, and strangers were truly existent or existing in the way they appear to us, each sentient being would always remain in whatever category he or she is presently found. However, our experience is that relationships change. So to hold anybody in one of those categories to be true is a mistake on our part. I think I told that story, a number of times, was so, it had a big impact on me. You know, because I thought like my friend's wife was a particular type of person. That's like saying, you're like this from your side. You know, and I thought, you're a bee because you behave like this to my best mate. You know, you're his wife and you behave like this. You are, you know, in this category. Which I think, you know, like, that's you. So, you know, years and years later, you know, we talked about it. I just had this really bad morning that day, Eddie, and da da da. And I was like, oh, the light's gone, of course, you know, like, oh, that's right. Everybody has these bad days, doesn't it? Doesn't mean because you have a bad day, you're a bad person. And that's what I'd done. I'd put her in the category of bad people I don't want anything to do with. And this is what it's saying here. There's also that, you know, the story we used to give Adolf Hitler's classified, put in the category of monster. You know, there are monsters, nobody should love them. But his dog loved him. Can't be a monster. So, you know, don't fit the category. And that's right, the categories are not truly existent. They're just basically words we use to describe things, but in that way of doing it, this reified view goes, no, you're that. The way I describe you, you are that. It's that same thing, you know, we learned later on in school and so forth, that, you know, people have bad behaviors, people behave badly, but they're not bad people. So it's the same sort of thing here. You know, people do behave unskillfully and badly, and we call them something, and we think, that's what you are. I named you that, that's what you are. And that's not true. Yeah, so things change all the time. So to put them into these categories with any sort of solidity, that's a mistake on our part. That being the case, what's asked of us is to overcome our disinterest in their welfare. And lastly, dependent designation. So let me ask this, is like how do... This is going to be strange because I did this myself. I thought, wow, that's... So when we can't find... there is no self within us to be found, is there? We don't find the self within us. Yet self does exist. The self does exist. So you go, well, then how? Like, what is it? If it's not something we can find within us, and it's not, you know, our feelings, our body, our mind, all these sort of things. Right? Like, what is it? And the answer is, it's just a name given to all that stuff. Just like this thing, right? This clock, right? It's a name given to all the parts. If you pull all these parts apart, there's no clock in there, is there? No individual part is the clock. The name clock is given to everything here. Just like the name I is given to everything there, right? And here. So look at that. I there, I here. Is there and here the same thing? No, they're not, aren't they? But the same name, I, is given to there and here. But from a rich perspective, I is over there. Oh, you'd say it's here, right? I'm here. I am here. And I'd say, no, I'm here. Well, how can you be here if I'm here? But we are, aren't we? From her perspective, here is there. From mine, here is here. And what's over, that's there. But from Yvette's perspective, I am not here, I am there. It's like from my perspective, Yvette is not here, she's there. You can do the same. I remember this many, many years ago when I was a youngster first involving myself in pot smoking and taking different hallucinogens. And I remember one time, like, sitting there in my imagination, and the same thing happened, like I found later on in the texts, right? In my mind, I imagined myself being on the bank of a river. And it was this thing of, like, this is this bank. But then I was going, like, well, if I went to that bank would become this bank. And this bank where I was would become that bank. And it was like, Jesus, where's the bank? If it's not, you know, so here and there, this and that, I and self are just dependent designations. Right? You can, like I said, like the riverbank was great. Of course, I drew the wrong conclusion, being a young fellow having no background in Buddhist philosophy, right? I drew the conclusion, it's like, God, there's no bank. Then I went for the bank to time, you know, and he's like, oh, what about time then? And again, you can't find present time. You can't find past time. You can't find a future time. Does this mean time doesn't exist like I thought? No. Wrong conclusion, Eddie. These all exist as mere names put upon the perspective. Now, so you know, my conversations with my present partner, I'm a little bit infuriating for her because I often say it depends. You know, because it does. It's everything is dependent. So you don't want to get too clingy to your views. You know, I think it's just this way. But from the perspective of the other, it could be another way. So here, as Holiness says, self and others are dependent designations. And this is the thing I tried the other day and go, wow, is they depend on each other. Just as this side of the valley and that side of the valley are positive in mutual dependence on the other. Depending where we stand, one side is labeled this or that. These labels change depending on our viewpoint. Similarly, calling one set of aggregates I or other is dependent. So the aggregates are the body of mind, so I call this set of aggregates my body of mind, I. I call your set of aggregates, you. From your perspective, you call your set of aggregates, I. And my set of aggregates, you. The aggregates I currently call I, other people call other. If they were inherently mine, then everyone would see them as mine, but other people see them as other. So in other words, I thought, you're like, if I identify myself with my body and mind and saying, this is me, then from your perspective, you should be seeing me as me. That's what follows, right? But you don't, do you? You see me as you. So again, just so you don't cling too tightly to the name, right? The name is just the name. It exists, of course. It's imputed to these phenomena. Doesn't truly exist because of this. These changes that take place depend upon the perspective. Now, this conclusion of nature is that as I have no justification at all to hold grudges against persons that cause me harm, I must overcome any biased feelings I have towards them. And ignoring disinterest in their welfare, decide to never neglect them. You know, self and others are the same. This is what you're trying to get at here. There's no difference between me and others at this deep level. At this deep level. On other levels, of course, there's plenty of differences. But we're talking about a little bit deeper beyond the surface. Yeah, so again, from the first side, so these three sort of complement one another. So we go back to that. This thing of going back to one's own side, it says we're not inherently, we do not exist from our own side. So self, other, friend, enemy, stranger do not exist from their own side. If they did, it says here the Buddhas would see them to exist in that way, but they don't see that. From our perspective, that's how it appears. That friends, enemies, strangers, myself and you all exist from our own sides. But that's how it appears to us. But it doesn't exist that way. So what we've got to do to find out where that is actually true is to analyze to see, and you go, okay, if I existed in that way, as I seem to, how would I exist? So if I existed, as suppose you all looked at me and thought, oh, Eddie's a nice guy, I'll call him a friend. Right? So if I existed as a friend from my own side, everybody should see me as a friend. But that's not the case, is it? Lots of people come and go, I don't know him. I've never seen him before. No, he's just a stranger to me. So, you know, from their perspective. So obviously I can't be from my own side. And so again, like I said, the idea of Adolf Hitler appearing, he does, as a monstrous person, right? Then everybody should see him as a monster. Well, his mother didn't, neither did his dog. And probably lots of other people around him at that time did not see him as a monster. So no, he doesn't exist like that from his own sight. We just call him that. People call them monsters, give them different names to describe their behavior and so forth. But they're not like that from their own side. Like I'm saying, from their own side means that everybody should perceive them like that, but we don't. So there's nothing existing from its own side. And again, from their own side means if you search the basis of designation, which in this case would be the body and mind of Adolf Hitler, for the monster, none found. This is really good for ourselves too. Like, you know, it's quite often quite easy to denigrate ourselves, to speak harshly to oneself. Right? Look for that self you're speaking so harshly about. It's not there. But you just imagined it. It's such a self existed. You existed like that. But like I said, your nervous system and mind can't tell what's true and what's false. It takes everything to be true. So if you describe yourself in these unskillful ways, that's the effect you're going to get. You don't have to be a monster to feel like one or to be seen in the world as a monster. This is what I'm sort of saying, right? And so I noticed in Alone how the people, so much of stuff is like eye-based. And then when you start to fail, they talk badly about themselves and their failures. Right? I'm not good enough. I need, you know, it's like this big thing. There's no real eye there like that. That eye, which is non-existent, can't measure up to what you expect and want to do. Why? Because there's no eye like that. So in summary, these three conclusions are, in terms of others, I will care as deeply for you as I care for myself. Because we are equal in our wishes to be happy, in our wishes to be free from suffering. Simply put, and in terms of oneself, so I will help you overcome your suffering. Why? Because it's suffering, just like my own. And finally, deepest nature, I will not neglect you. In summary, we conclude that prioritizing ourselves or oneself is logically baseless, has no foundation at all. And that self-centeredness causes all the suffering, while cherishing others brings all the joy. And that because, you know, all the social labels are mere mental constructs, an active universal care is the only rational choice. And that's what came to me going through this again. And I go, oh my gosh, imagine if everybody became familiar with this way of thinking. One of the things that Holiness is that the terrible thing, if you don't adopt this type of thinking, is always this imbalance, right? One group of people will hold themselves more privileged than the others. So you'll have a large mass of humanity really unhappy in the world, and a few people quite, well, when they're not content, they always want more. Right? And then we know what happens, you know. We've had these revolutions in the past. There's going to be a lot of suffering, that's for sure. You know, I was just thinking of the science fiction movies like where the people get off planet. So one group of people are really rich and they build some sort of space thing up there. They go down on Earth, all the humans are suffering. And then up there, they cause suffering again because they haven't actually got rid of the causes. You know, so you often find that up in the space station where they're all sort of safe, they start arguing. They do all the stuff and they go, yeah, doesn't quite work, does it? Demi.
Even with revolution.
No, that's right. It might start off with a good intention to bring about the welfare of the whole group of people. But many times the people that want to do it, they also want to punish the other people that were hurting them. So Yeah, that's right. Now, and then, of course, if you have that attitude, well, when you're in power, now, you know, all the other people sort of become problematic, don't they? And then you're willing to hurt them. So, well, nothing really got solved here. We just took one group of powerful, hurting people, removed them, and put a new lot in. And now they do the same thing. And we'll see this if you look over history, it just happens again and again and again and again. Never really changed in 2,000 years. I think it's just much more dangerous now. You know, now we have the capacity to wipe out the whole planet over and over again through all sorts of different ways. And you ask yourself, what's driving that? You go, somebody's idea. Wrong idea. Okay, we're just about over, so let's do a quick meditation. And our last slide. Yeah, so just get yourself upright, find a nice posture, drop your shoulders, just check your head, it's nice and even on your neck, and let this body breathe itself. Now recollect that all beings have been your closest friends and relatives throughout time. And that everything sustaining your life was produced and given by others. So without discriminating, can you recognize the immense kindness you've received? If you're holding on to old hurts or grudges, let them go and meet all beings with a sort of a balanced, equanimous presence. Now, as we are, all of us, subject to impermanence and death, clinging to wrongdoing only creates more suffering. And harming others caught in cycles which are similar to ourselves serves no great purpose, as we all face the same end. So joy arises from wishing that others and ourselves be happy, and misery stems from the thoughts that wish others unhappiness, or we're just seeking pleasure for oneself. So imagine abandoning attachment, aversion, and indifference. And imagine having done so, you have a really warm and friendly attitude towards all beings. So though others occasionally hurt us, sort of cultivate a sort of compassionate acceptance of this. By recognizing that resistance breeds more suffering. And do your best to just meet situations with an equanimous presence, neither rejecting nor grasping. I'm trying to carry a sense of kindness that is equally extended to all. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. Okay, so this last slide is a way of discerning the difference between the two types of equanimity that developed in the six causes and the other one developed here. So the equanimity developed in the six causes, one effect is called a mere equanimity, and it's a preliminary. And this levels the playing ground of friends, enemies, and strangers. It is not necessarily a Mahayana way of developing equanimity. All, whether you're Mahayana or the other vehicles, this is the major way of fruit for the other vehicles is this way. The Mahayana doesn't like what we just talked about. And this other way is called mere equanimity. Just to let you know, there's another type. And that is the one we've just talked about. Equanimity developed between equalizing self and others levels it between us and others. Now, one way you can do this to recognize this is imagine you have friends in front of you, strangers and enemies, and there is yourself. If you ask, who is the most important person amongst all these people, friends, enemies, strangers, and myself? It comes to me. Right? So it's sort of saying this. I recognize that. Right? Now, is there such a real difference between yourself and the other? And if I know, because self is merely imputed, it's just a name. From the other side, the other is called self. Right? So this is, so I'd be going, yeah, it's me. And you'd be going, yeah, it's me. Mel would go, yeah, I know I'm more important than my friends, enemies, and strangers. So it's trying to get at that, you know, that sort of grasping at that. There's a big difference between me and you. And I'm more important. This economy is trying to tackle that. Okay. So there's four questions to this. I've given you the answers to them. If you can, just try and find any writing by His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa Rinpoche on this practice. It's really well explained in commentaries on the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So you'll see, I see four books up there for sale for $5. So you'll find the method in there. If you can, try just to memorize the conclusions. If you've forgotten them already or haven't written down, they'll be up in the space there. You can just go, I will never neglect you, and so forth. Just start there with the three major ones and just sort of, settle inside yourself. And coming up, we're going to look at the real major obstacle, one of the major obstacles to cherishing others is cherishing self. Right? So we're going to have a look at what that actually is and what we can do about it. Okay, so let's dedicate the energy that you've put into the class. Due to the merits of his virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The prayer for His Holiness is a long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the discovery and swift return of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request. Here we go. Thank you, everyone.